This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we dedicate this show to the memory of Michael Ratner.
We work with Michael every week for 11 years, and we promised him we'd keep this show going.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Michael Ratner died after an 8-month battle with cancer on May 11th of 2016. Today, we dedicate our show and reflect back on Michael Ratner's contribution to the movement and his role in the show Law and Disorder. Heidi, how did you first meet Michael?
Michael, when I started working at the National Lawyers Guild in 1999, I, of course, knew of Michael's reputation and the many cases he's brought and the various issues that he championed over the years. I first actually saw him at a Columbia Law School event in 1999. I think it was involving Cuba and the embargo. And then in my office, I saw his name everywhere because he was a longtime supporter of the Guild in many respects and was universally loved, respected, admired, and seen as a mentor to many new generations of young radical attorneys and legal workers. Then you called me in 2004 and invited me to be a part of this show. And so I really started to get to know Michael, the person, that year, and remember soon after attending an award ceremony at Columbia Law School where he got their Public Interest Law Foundation Award in 2005, and also the Columbia Law School Medal of Honor. And from there, as Law and Disorder took off, it's just been a mixture of really rare, serious, thoughtful interviews, interactions with a lot of good humor thrown in. The humanity also that Michael brought, unexpected surprises. I remember once after speaking about my Armenian grandfather and mother escaping the genocide, a few weeks later a big box arrived from Amazon with no name on it, and I opened it up and it was a really heavy, complete anthology on the Armenian genocide, and I quickly realized Michael had sent it without a note, just a very thoughtful, generous person. Michael, I know that you go back far longer than I do with Michael, so I'd like to hear how you first met him, but I also know that he had an interesting take on the rule of law.
A take that we all share, but I first met him when I lived around the corner from him in Greenwich Village back in the early 80s. And Michael had just gotten elected as the president of the National Lawyers Guild. And he walked around the corner and schlepped up 4 flights of stairs to our walk-up where I was living with my wife, Debbie, and our very young son, Eli. And he asked me if I would be on the editorial board of Guild Notes, which was the Lawyers Guild magazine. I said, sure, I'd like to do that. And that's when I started working with Michael. Michael's conception of the law, American law, well, he initially started out, I guess like we all did, Heidi, thinking that the law was a civilized way of resolving disputes. And whatever defects it might have, those could be fixed. Well, he quickly realized that that was not the case. And he came to understand that the law was a method of social control exercised by the 1% over the rest of us and exercised by any means necessary for as long as possible so they could keep their privileges and power. And that was the perspective that Michael had throughout his entire adult life as a litigator. He wanted to expose the law, undercut the law, change it if he could, change it in tandem with the movement because he thought that lawyers in the final analysis played an auxiliary role and that it was the people's movement that caused social change. But he thought that the movement could make use of the law and he wanted to be an instrument in that endeavor.
Michael, we had a lot of fun over the last 14 years and I will cherish these memories. We've been likened here on Law and Disorder by a few as the Car Talk of Legal Affairs show. And I also remember when I got an award from the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild in 2011, you and Michael introduced my getting that award and were as humorous and insightful and really magnanimous as you always have been on the radio show. And I thought that sort of summarized the kind of working relationship we had.
We weren't that magnanimous. You did a good job. You ran the Guild for 15 years, and the Guild caused a lot of trouble under your tenure, Heidi.
I hope you mean good rabble-rousing.
But, you know, I think we should say something about some of the cases that
yes.
Michael handled and talk about how he came to do what he did. He came from an upper-middle-class Jewish family in Cleveland, went to Brandeis, which was a fairly radical place in the 60s. You know, Herbert Marcuse, the famous philosopher, was there. He was a classmate of Angela Davis's. When he got out, he was accepted to Columbia Law School. He wasn't all that political then. He devoted his first year exclusively to studying, did pretty well, came out first in his class, went on to the Law Review.
Not surprising.
But what changed him was what happened when the police attacked the students at Columbia back in 68. Columbia had been expanding its campus into the Harlem area. It wanted to build a gymnasium with two entrances, one for the privileged Columbia students and one for the Harlem population. And it was also extensively tied up with America's prosecution of the war in Vietnam. So the students held a sit-in, and the Columbia authorities called the cops on the sit-in. Michael was caught up in that, beaten up. 700 people were arrested. 200 people were sent to the hospital. The National Lawyers Guild came and defended those students.
That became really the beginning of their well-known mass defense program, and they've been defending people in the streets of protest ever since.
It certainly did. I mean, the Lawyers Guild was really a victim of the McCarthy era, which we were just coming out of even in the 60s. And that defense revivified the Lawyers Guild in New York City and then later on nationally. And Michael was on the ground floor of that. So then he went on when he graduated from law school. He worked for the Legal Defense Fund, which was the legal arm of the Black
NAACP,
movement at the time.
Right.
Moved down to Baltimore, lived in a motel, did work on school desegregation, came back to New York, got a job with Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first black judge in the federal judiciary.
And he always spoke so highly of her.
And vice versa. She thought he was the best clerk she ever had. And then in 71, when he finished his clerkship, he started working for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was a scrappy, small little organization then. The first week, they sent him up to Buffalo to the Attica prison. Rockefeller was the governor then. Rockefeller wanted to be the president. He didn't want to be looked upon as being soft on prisoners. And when the Attica prisoners took over the prison, the governor called in the state troopers. 43 people were murdered by the state troopers. The Center for Constitutional Rights got in on it and sent Michael up to take statements to try to figure out what to do. And so Michael's first lawsuit was actually called Attica People Against Rockefeller. They tried to get the state to appoint a prosecutor to prosecute the murderers. They didn't succeed on that. But that started Michael off in his political representation from 1971 until 2015.
And Michael, I think for listeners who may not totally understand the nuances of some lawyering, Michael was really a radical attorney, and that's kind of a dying breed. Lawyers who will really take chances. They will take cases because they believe so firmly in the underlying principle and the violations that have occurred that even if the possibility of success in court is very low, they will still take the case to get that message out into the public's eye.
Yeah,
and that Michael believed in that.
Absolutely. And you know, to work with the movement in doing that.
Yeah.
He didn't believe American law in the final analysis was compatible with democracy, nor did he believe that it was compatible with the rule of law. We saw that most clearly with what happened after 9/11 and the setting up of the offshore prison in Cuba, the creation of a surveillance state, the massive harassment, the militarization of the police, the FBI's spying. But Michael understood that fundamentally. He knew that the rule of law and democracy was not compatible with capitalist law. And he knew that capitalism wasn't compatible with an egalitarian society. And it was that understanding, I think, that empowered him in the litigation that he undertook.
Michael was also an activist, as I think we all are on the show. He opposed Abu Ghraib torture and prisoner abuse, as well as the Iraq War. He served as an expert witness at a mock tribunal staged by the Bush Crimes Commission at the Columbia University. More recently, in May 2014, he resigned from the advisory board of the International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life at Brandeis, where, as you said, he went to school, because the university's president cut ties with Al-Quds, a Palestinian university, after a student demonstration there. So that's who Michael was. If he saw an injustice, he would do something about it.
No, he was in total solidarity with the Palestinian people. In fact, he organized and got the financial support to set up Palestine Legal, which is fighting back against the repression of,
right,
of Palestinian
with the New York,
students.
With the National Lawyers Guild.
Absolutely.
Right. That was very important and still is.
I think that if you want to look back at some of his most significant cases, Heidi, he sued Ronald Reagan,
yes,
for the funding of Contras in Nicaragua,
right,
and for invading Grenada. He sued George Bush 41, the first one, for invading Iraq without congressional authority.
Mm-hmm.
He sued Bill Clinton for warehousing Haitians with HIV in the offshore prison camp, which we now know as Guantanamo.
He served as special counsel to Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, assisting in prosecuting human rights crimes.
He sued the Secretary of Defense under Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, for torture. He sued Indonesian generals, a Guatemalan defense minister who he served when the guy was being given a degree at Harvard. He sued a Haitian dictator, all for human rights abuses.
And he tried to get Clinton to stop the strategic bombing during the Kosovo War.
He sued the FBI for spying on Central American Solidarity activists and CSPES during the 80s. He sued the Pentagon for restricting press coverage of the Gulf War.
He won a case on behalf of victims of the Bosnian Serb leader for war crimes.
And he organized what they called the Guantanamo Bar Association, which was the greatest mass mobilization of lawyers the country's ever seen. He got 500 lawyers to come in after they won the case of Rasul versus Bush, which established that the prisoners in the offshore prison camp in Guantanamo had the right to habeas corpus. They had the right to challenge their detention. They had the right to go in front of a court and tell the judge, I don't think I'm being held legally. Let's look into this. A habeas corpus, the fundamental, it's written into the U.S. Constitution. And he restored the habeas corpus and then organized 500 lawyers to continue with those cases. They didn't totally win, but they got 500 out of some 700 prisoners out of there.
A Herculean task.
You know, and we should also mention that he was the president of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights,
right,
which is kind of the European version of the
CCR.
CCR, yeah.
And I think when it all comes down to his legacy, he will be remembered as a compassionate, loving, really humanitarian attorney who was really loved by all who knew him.
And that sea of people, which includes you and me, Heidi, and our producer, Jeff Brady, who he influenced and continues to motivate. I wanted to say something about Michael in perspective, because Michael Ratner had no funeral. He wasn't religious. Religion to him was superstition. Being part of a sect was too narrow and confining. The Jewish heretic who transcends Jewry belongs to a Jewish tradition. The historian Isaac Deutscher had a phrase for it, the non-Jewish Jew. Michael Ratner was in line with the great heretics, rebels, and revolutionaries of modern thought, Spinoza, Heine, Marx, Luxembourg, Trotsky, Freud. They all went beyond the boundaries of Jewry, finding it too narrow, archaic, constricting. I don't wish to stretch the comparison. Michael was not so much a radical thinker as a man of action, but his intellectual understanding, and he was extremely well-educated, powered his activity. He had in common with these great thinkers the idea that for knowledge to be real, it must be acted upon. As Marx observed, hitherto philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point now is to change it. Like his intellectual predecessors, Michael Ratner saw reality in a state of flux, as dynamic and not static, and he was aware of the constantly changing and contradictory nature of society. Michael was essentially an optimist and shared with the great Jewish revolutionaries an optimistic belief in humanity and a belief in the solidarity of humankind.
Michael Ratner cared deeply about freedom of the press, whistleblowing, and the public's right to know. As counsel to Julian Assange, he spoke often about the case. This segment was recorded on the third anniversary of Julian's detention in the Ecuadorian embassy, where he had been granted political asylum. Let's take a listen.
Michael Ratner, last week was the second anniversary of Julian Assange being stuck in the embassy, Ecuadorian embassy in London. Can you tell us an update on that?
Yes, he's been there now 2 years. It was June 19th, 2 years ago, when Julian walked into the embassy. He asked for political asylum, which a few weeks later, the Ecuadorians, who must be heavily thanked, gave him political asylum. So he's sitting in the embassy with political asylum. I have visited him there many times. Don't get any idea in your head that it's some big, fancy, luxurious embassy. It's an apartment on a ground floor with about 6 or 8 rooms. He has one of those rooms. It's small. There's no outside space. He has to have a sun lamp because there's not really any sun he can get, a little bit through the windows, but it's not enough. It's a custody. He's in custody, and not of the Ecuadorians, but he's essentially can't leave those rooms, and he's in a particular place. He's not allowed to walk out on the street. There's permanent...
Michael, are there police, like, outside waiting?
Yes, there's police. You go up there. There's police right in front. There's a policeman inside on the first floor when you walk in. They're at every window. There's a big couple of police vans outside with antenna picking up every one of your conversations. That's where Julian has been for 2 years.
Michael, tell me, and refresh our audience, what did Julian do to deserve this, and what can we do to get him out of it?
Well, let me back up for a second. I think one thing that's important for everybody to know is that Julian's in pretty good shape in there. I mean, he's been functioning. WikiLeaks has been functioning. It's done remarkable work while he's been in there. The first thing, and I think a key thing that people have to understand, is they basically, WikiLeaks, Sarah Harrison, Julian, and others, saved Edward Snowden from going to prison in the United States. Remember, he was in Hong Kong. The U.S. issued a criminal complaint against him. 2 counts of espionage. One count of theft of documents. This is against Edward Snowden. There was an extradition request by the U.S., Hong Kong being part of China. The likelihood is that 90%, 95%, or 100% that Edward Snowden would have wound up in a U.S. jail. Instead of that, WikiLeaks helped him gain asylum, where he eventually did in Russia. Sarah Harrison accompanied him on the plane to Moscow, filed, as far as I know, filed applications for asylum for him, and eventually he got it. So they played a heroic role for Edward Snowden. It's one that has been recognized by many people. Glenn Greenwald in particular has said in his book, in acknowledgments in the back of the book, saying, but for the work of WikiLeaks, Sarah Harrison, we would not have Edward Snowden participating in the debates right now about what the National Security Agency has done. So while he is While Julian Assange is in the embassy, cannot leave, he is doing effective work. Think of another story we've covered on here, Heidi and Michael Smith. We've covered the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's the so-called trade agreement the U.S. is trying to impose on countries, particularly in the Far East. That's very unfair to the number of those countries, as well as to, of course, populations encompassed in those countries. They've exposed the negotiating terms of those, of some of those agreements, and that's been very, very critical. So they've done a huge amount of work while Julian is in there.
Michael, what kind of pressure, if any, is the U.S. government putting on the embassy? And how long can Julian remain there, do you think?
It's an important question. I think the U.S. is the bear in the room here. We could deal with, and I'll go over each country, we could deal with Sweden, we could deal with the U.K., we could deal, obviously Ecuador has been favorable. It's the U.S. where we have a real issue. The U.S., since I've started working on the case and before, for 4 years now, has had a criminal investigation going against Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. They've had a grand jury. It's huge investigation, serious investigation. The Chelsea Manning trial, it came out that there was files of, you know, perhaps 50,000 or more files and documents. That was back then, a couple of years ago. There's many more than that. There's 20 agencies that have been investigating him. And if there's any doubt in anyone's mind whether this investigation is continuing, despite claims by Holder, oh, we're not going to prosecute journalists, what the U.S. just admitted in April of 2014, a few months ago, they filed a brief in federal court. It was a brief in which they were trying to refuse to give up documents in a Freedom of Information Act case. And their claim was they couldn't give them up because there's a continuing investigation going. It was documents that we sought around WikiLeaks, or that actually Epic sought, the group we interviewed last week on our show. And they came up with what's called the continuing investigation excuse. And in that brief filed in federal court, they said, the Department of Justice said, there's an ongoing criminal national security investigation into WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. It's multi-subject and it's ongoing. And it's huge. So that investigation is still continuing. When I say it's the bear in the room, Julian Assange, let's say he somehow was able, or Sweden, in any case, was able, and we'll get to that in a second, able to deal with what the sexual misconduct allegations in Sweden and deal with some other issues. If he walked out of that embassy, he might very well likely be hit with extradition to the United States, whether that would be from the UK or Sweden if he ultimately got there. And of course, that and the conditions he would face would be awful. If we look at what happened to Chelsea Manning, from torture to 35 years in prison, to our special units of prisons that don't allow any talking outside, et cetera, very harsh conditions. That's, in fact, one of the reasons that Ecuador gave Julian Assange asylum, first because he was persecuted as a whistleblower, and secondly, and perhaps as equally important, is that he would not receive a fair trial, and the conditions in the United States were awful. So that's the United States. Now let's look at a couple of other things that have happened. As I said, Ecuador has given him asylum. Once you've been given asylum, the conventions and the laws basically say that another country cannot interfere with the right of asylum. So here's Julian Assange sitting in Ecuadorian embassy in London, having been given asylum, and yet the British, the UK, refuses to give him a free passage to Ecuador out of that embassy. That's considered
obstruction
of his right to asylum. Likewise, if Julian went to Sweden, Sweden has refused to guarantee that they would honor his right to asylum and send him to Ecuador rather than send him to the United States.
So, also obstruction.
So that you see that Sweden and the UK are both interfering with the Ecuadorian grant to Julian of political asylum.
And can I ask, what recourse is there to confront those countries legally?
Well, they're certainly being confronted diplomatically, and the question is whether and when Julian Assange decides to go into some kind of international court to try and guarantee the right of asylum. Of course, once you go into court, you know, one problem is, of course, then the country say, well, it's in court, we're not going to say, and that could take many years. So, and you don't know the result, of course, although I do think he has a very strong claim that both Sweden and the UK are interfering with his right of asylum and that right to go to Ecuador. Now, let's look at Sweden for a second. There's a couple of things that have to be explained about Sweden. It's been 4 years, really, since the allegations of sexual misconduct have been made against Julian Assange by two women, but particularly by the prosecutor, who seems to have vengeance to carry this out. Now, just remember, they're allegations, they're not charges. They asked to extradite Julian Assange based on those allegations. The British courts upheld that extradition based on merely allegations.
Is that unusual?
It's unusual in this sense in particular. Britain was one of the only countries that allowed that. And secondly, Britain, because of the Assange case, actually has changed the law now. Allegations from a prosecutor from another country are not sufficient to get someone extradited. But of course, the British in their great wisdom said it's not retroactive. So now you have a situation where if Julian Assange had to face extradition today for the allegations in Sweden, if he had to face that today, he would not be extradited. There would be no order for extradition. So the law has been changed. You now need, in the UK, a decision to prosecute, a decision to charge, rather, a decision to charge.
Which is sort of like an indictment in our country.
Right, and a decision that you're going to do it.
Right.
Right. And they haven't done that. And 4 years later, they still haven't done it. And if we add to that with regard to Sweden, for these 2 years he's been in the embassy, he has said he is willing to answer the questions that Sweden wants to ask him. That is why they wanted him in Sweden, to ask questions of him. That's what the extradition warrant was about. He's asked four times. I'll do it by video. I'll do it by phone. I'll do it in person if you want to come and visit me at the embassy. I'll do it any way you want, in written questions. And so far, the prosecutor over these 2 years has refused to come to the embassy in any of those forms and ask any questions of Julian Assange. So when you ask who's delaying this case, who's holding it up, you have to say that somehow Sweden is just unwilling to ask questions. Perhaps they like Julian Assange in limbo.
Of course, it sounds like that. But my question is, isn't there some kind of statute of limitations about how many years they can be in this limbo without charging or doing anything else?
Assuming the statutes of limitations run in this case, which I think they do, that some of the charges or allegations, there are no charges, some of the allegations will be stale or out of date within 5 years. So within another year, some of those allegations will start dropping off. Not all of them may have longer than a 5 year window. Now, the other thing about Sweden that's important is just last week, because of what's happened in Sweden with two issues. One, they have the worst reputation in the European Union for pretrial detention. They just stick people in prison all the time, not just wanting to do Julian had he gone there, but all the time. And they have a terribly arbitrary system of prosecutors that are not controlled by the judges or by the judicial system. And so what's happened in this case, where do you go when a prosecutor doesn't do what she is supposed to do, which is go to the embassy and ask questions of Julian, as they've done many times in other cases in Sweden, in other countries. So what happened last week is really significant. Is there's a Sweden's human rights record is reviewed every 4 years, like all countries, for their compliance with human rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic and Social Justice, what we call the International Bill of Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Sweden is up for review in September. By June 15th of this year, people who were involved in human rights are permitted to put in briefs, et cetera, to the UN as to whether Sweden has complied or not with its human rights record. Now, when I say on June 15th, not one, not two, but 59 different civic and human rights organizations put in briefs saying that Sweden has failed to comply with its human rights obligations. It's called the Universal Periodic Review.
Right.
So 59 countries are now complaining, not countries, but human rights organizations and others, the arbitrary denial of rights to Julian Assange and in general that take place in Sweden. So Sweden
That's impressive.
Right. Sweden is out of compliance with its with its human rights obligations. It's failed to really follow up on allegations, and it's sat there. And I think things are going to beginning to break open in Sweden about this, because in fact Sweden looks terrible.
Right.
Sweden, this country that everybody supposedly thinks is so great, it turns out it's not. But in this respect, certainly, we have seen firsthand that it's not. So we have Sweden being involved in that. We have the UK having changed the law so he could no longer be extradited, refusing to recognize his right to asylum. And then the US, the big bear in the room. My hopes for this case.
But Michael, before you go to your hopes, what about Ecuador? I'm still just concerned. Might they say after another year or so, we're sick of this arrangement, Julian, you have to go?
Ecuador has been extremely supportive of Julian. There was recently, they do these, I think they're called encuentros or something like that, where President Correa talks about various issues. And I think recently there was done about their obligations to Julian Assange. I think that Ecuador has really stood up in a way that, you know, that is just very remarkable and amazing. And, of course, Correa will be president for at least, I think, another 3 years now. Hopefully this case will be resolved in a year. I want to close the segment on another important initiative. There's a letter that will be sent within the next few days to our Attorney General, Eric Holder, by at least 30 or so human rights groups from around the world. From Anthony Romero at the ACLU to Article 19 from the UK to others. And that letter basically wants to hold Holder to his words that journalists and editors will not be subject to prosecution. And it starts off with a demand to close all criminal investigations of WikiLeaks and its editor-in-chief, Julian Assange. It says that they have to stop harassing and persecuting Julian and WikiLeaks for publishing that is done in the public interest. They go back to Holder's promise that no reporter would go to jail for doing his job. Yet, of course, it appears that they want to send Julian Assange to jail for doing that. It ends with the words, the investigation must come to a close of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
Michael, just so we can see the forest from the trees, Julian Assange is a publisher. And my question in a nutshell is, what did he publish that exposed the United States with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan?
You know, it's remarkable. WikiLeaks has existed since certainly 2008, maybe before. There were documents that came out in Chelsea Manning about wanting to destroy WikiLeaks even before the most serious documents came out. But in a nutshell, he started off with Chelsea Manning's collateral murder video, which shows the incredible bloodlust of Americans in a helicopter, gunship, killing two Reuters journalists. Then when the bodies are going to be picked up, shooting at the van that's going to pick them up, injuring two children, killing others. I mean, it's an incredibly blood-chilling video. That video, then they came up with what are called the Iraq war logs. The Iraq war logs just demonstrate blood-killing all over Iraq, 15,000 more civilians killed than the U.S. was willing to say, including the running of torture camps that the U.S. was fully knowledgeable about by the Iraqis, that people were tortured routinely in the mid-2000s, 2003, 2004, thousands of people tortured. That's Iraq. Then we have the Afghan war logs, similar to the numbers of killings that went on in Iraq, the targeting of people, the targeting of civilians, the bloodlust of that war. And then it ended with what really, I think, if you were to say one set of documents, really said to the United States government, we're going to put this guy out of business. It's what we call the diplomatic cables or Cablegate, 250,000 low-level, relatively secret cables that expose the criminality, hypocrisy of the United States in dealing with countries all over the world. What came out of that, for example, a secret war in Yemen. What came out was the utter corruption of the Ben Ali government in Tunisia, which was one of the elements that led to the Arab Spring when the Tunisian government was overthrown. I could go on and on.
They were all an embarrassment to the U.S. government.
They were embarrassment, but they also demonstrated—
And illegal actions.
Right, criminality. They showed us that this government is utterly corrupted, utterly criminal, that its wars, as we now see every day, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, and as Chelsea Manning herself testified, were just fought in a way that was just going to make people hate the United States. And they already did. We were invaders and occupiers. And that's what these documents showed.
Michael, if this has moved our listeners to want to take some action, where do they go?
There's a new website called FreeAssangeNow.org, FreeAssangeNow.org. Go to that website, find out about the case. There's a donate button, and I'll just end this segment by reading you the quote that's on the front page of that website. Quote, "Someone who courageously carries out actions in defense of democratic rights deserves applause, not hysterical denunciation and punishment." Noam Chomsky on Assange.
In the next former update, Michael Ratner discussed how Israel continues to slaughter innocent Palestinian civilians. using disproportionate force. It's called the Dahiya Doctrine. The Israelis are practicing what they call the Dahiya Doctrine. What is this?
Well, at least many of us believe, and I think they are, practicing what's called the Dahiya Doctrine. For all our listeners, it's D-A-H-I-Y-A. And I like to call, when I talk about this, the Dahiya Doctrine, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange. Because the first cable that illustrated what the Dahiya Doctrine was or is came out of WikiLeaks. And it has to do with the way Israel fights its wars against Palestinians or others. Dahiya was a section of Beirut in Lebanon. And what the Israelis did in the 2006 war is they leveled that section entirely. Everything, every building, nothing stood. Disproportionate force. Disproportionate force is, of course, a key guideline to whether you're committing a war crime or not. It's a war crime to use disproportionate force. If you want to kill an enemy soldier in a neighborhood, you can't kill 10,000 civilians to kill one soldier. You can't kill 100. You have to use what's called proportional force. You can't go after civilian objects. You can't go after civilians or civilian homes. Well, the Dahiya Doctrine is what Israel actually practiced in 2006, leveling a neighborhood, a form of collective punishment, a form of what Israel is saying, we're going to do to anybody that attacks us. We're going to show them it's not simply an eye for an eye. It's your entire body. It's your whole infrastructure. It's everything. That's 2006. Right after that demolishment of a village in part of Beirut, a general from Israel said, what we have now is the Dahiya Doctrine. And it's not just a proposal. That's what we do. And he actually said, we will use disproportionate force when we're fighting these wars. So that's an open and notorious admission of a war crime.
A so-called party admission.
It's a party admission from a legal term. But yes, it's basically saying we're committing a war crime. Because if you look at the Geneva Conventions, it says you can't use disproportionate force. And here you have a general saying, we're going to use disproportional force. And that's not a proposal, he says. That's an approved doctrine. So now we flash forward to this recent war, if you want to call it that, the recent massacre that took place in Gaza. And, of course, we've been reading about what's going on there, and you look at the statistics from the Palestine Committee on Human Rights, for example. 2,168 people have been killed. 2,168. Of that, 76.6% are civilians. Three-quarters are civilians. Of that, 30% of the civilians killed are children. 23% overall are children. So of this 2,168, 24% roughly were children. So that's what you would call the practice of the Dahiya Doctrine. The overwhelming use of force, disproportionate use of force, that winds up killing way more civilians than appropriate military targets. Now, the second part of that, of course, is a report that came out of the United Nations recently. Someone named Pernille Ironside, who's in charge of UNICEF for the UN, and she's been spending her time in Gaza, gave a very important press conference last week about the damage that's going on in Gaza. And the statistics were completely numbing. The main one that I take away from it is 400,000 people have been displaced in Gaza. That's basically one out of four people have been displaced. One out of four of a population of 1.8 million. Of that, 17,000 houses have been destroyed, 100,000 people completely homeless in Gaza. How long will it take them to rebuild that, assuming they ever get to rebuild it? She says a minimum of 18 years to rebuild it. So what you've seen is the utter and complete use of disproportionate force in Gaza, the Dahiya Doctrine. And I want to just close this segment to say, why are we standing by and allowing this to happen? Here we have a war crime being committed in front of our faces, admission by Israel it's doing it, a disclosure by WikiLeaks showing again the importance of WikiLeaks, and who's in prison or in exile or in an embassy? Julian Assange for exposing this type of document while the people committing these war crimes are going scot-free. And they're going scot-free for one major reason, and that's because the country we live in, the United States, gives them its full support. They can commit war crimes, and there's nothing, nothing or very little that people can do about it, at least in any of the so-called agencies, whether it's the UN or the UN or the UN courts or international courts. So the tragedy here is one, that obviously Palestinians are being killed in mass. Secondly, that war crimes are being committed openly and notoriously. And third, that the country, the United States, that we live in, is the fundamental supporter of those war crimes. And by that, I want to say, by that, every single member of Congress and the Senate and the House and Obama, who's approved it, who voted to continue to aid Israel in carrying out these war crimes, which is what that aid is doing, the military aid, is an aider and abettor of war crimes. Absolutely not any question under international law. So the key here for us in America, certainly, is to get the U.S. To stop its criminal support of Israel.
Michael Ratner was understandably proud of the Center for Constitutional Rights' work with SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, a support group formed in 1982. SNAP exposed predators and their protectors. It allows members to share their stories and educates communities about the impact of abuse. Let's take a listen to an update that Michael did on this topic.
Recently, the news, particularly here in New York, but really around the whole country, is filled with stories and anecdotes and statements of Archbishop, or at least formerly Archbishop of New York, Timothy M. Dolan, who has just been elevated to the position of cardinal in New York. I mean, you can't pick up a newspaper without seeing pictures of Cardinal Dolan everywhere. And what's interesting about Cardinal Dolan, of course, is he was formerly the Archbishop of Milwaukee. And that is a place in which he was implicated in some of the sexual scandals, or at least of not handling them right, some of the scandals around sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. And the Center for Constitutional Rights represents a group called SNAP, which is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And the center has brought a case at the International Criminal Court against both the Pope as well as the Committee for the Doctrine of the Propagation of the Faith, the former Inquisitor's Office at the Vatican, saying they should be implicated in the criminal violations of law by protecting abusers throughout the world, failing to report them to the police or the authorities, moving them around, allowing the abuse to continue. So the question now is, what about Cardinal Dolan? Well, the center issued a press release about Cardinal Dolan, but of course, in all of the wall-to-wall coverage of his elevation, nothing was mentioned about his role in sexual abuse scandals. Among the documents the center submitted to the International Criminal Court were letters between Dolan and then Cardinal Ratzinger, who of course is now the Pope, concerning a man named Father Franklin Becker. Becker was diagnosed as a pedophile as early as 1983, when serving where? Well, in Milwaukee, where Cardinal Dolan was. And though the Archdiocese of Milwaukee knew so, he continued to re-offend. Becker was nonetheless allowed to continue to work in several parishes. It was only when Becker was arrested in California in 2003 for sexual assault of a child that Dolan finally wrote to Ratzinger requesting that Becker be defrocked. Ratzinger's office replied that Dolan should inquire whether Becker would voluntarily request his own defrocking rather than be involuntarily defrocked by the Vatican. One case. Another one. Another example is evidenced by the case of prominent Harlem pastor Wallace A. Harris. In 2010, Harris, who had been accused of sexually assaulting more than 10 boys, was allowed to step down under a false pretense. Dolan, who by this time was already Archbishop of New York, quietly let him do so without informing the authorities or warning parishioners. More than a year and a half after the fact, the Vatican admonished him to live
that is, admonished Harris to live, quote, a life of prayer and penance. Due to the statute of limitations in New York, Harris has avoided criminal charges. So this is our new cardinal. This is our former archbishop, Milwaukee and New York. And this is who the papers bend over backwards. You could say, except I don't want to be disrespectful, you could say they genuflect to this cardinal.
Long before the term backdoor was in common parlance about computer security, in this past segment, Michael discusses a story that appeared in The Intercept on the so-called Sawmuggle program that takes in calls from every single caller in the Bahamas. Let's listen to Michael's discussion of this illegal backdoor entry by the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Well, a number of articles, or two of them really in particular, came out in the new magazine, The Intercept. That's the one that was founded by Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Jeremy Scahill, etc. It's part of First Look, the Omidyar piece, to supposedly publish material that other media won't publish. Well, the first big story that came out was about wiretapping or surveillance on five countries. Four of those countries, Mexico, Kenya, Philippines, and the Bahamas, were named. In three of those countries, Mexico, Kenya, and Philippines, the manner of surveillance was one called MYSTIC. That we're familiar with because that's where you take in all the metadata of people in those countries. Where they made the call from, who they're going to, how long the phone call is, but not necessarily take in the content. In the fourth country that Greenwald and others mentioned, it was the Bahamas. Bahamas, which are this chain of islands off the coast of the United States, originally British, have MYSTIC, but they also have another program called Somalget, S-O-M-A-L-G-E-T. Sounds pretty funny, Somalget. But the Somalget program, which is part of MYSTIC, takes in the content of every single call in the Bahamas. Let me say that again. Every single call made in and out of the Bahamas or in the Bahamas is taken in by this program, Somalget. It's held for 30 days. The content, this is our NSA doing this, the content is held for 30 days, and they can check it for whenever they want. So people are pretty outraged by that. What is it? There's terrorism in the Bahamas all of a sudden? What's going on here? Why are they doing this to the Bahamas? Well, it's partly experimental, I think, to see what they can do in getting every single phone call. What's interesting is it came in through an illegal back door. It's not that the Bahamas authorized this. It's that oftentimes countries in the world, whether the Bahamas or others, authorize the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to go into their phone system, but targeted to getting at DEA, drug enforcement.
Without users' knowledge, obviously.
But this time they went into the DEA structure, they put what are called backdoors in, and they had access to every single phone call and recorded every single phone call in the Bahamas. That's quite a good story. The story mentioned the people who vacationed in the Bahamas, Oprah Winfrey, and others like that. It means they were picking up all the phone conversations of tourists who went there. Then there became what was called a Twitter storm within a day of that. And it was between my client, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks on the one side, and really First Look Intercept on the other side, with Glenn and Julian going back and forth on this issue. Julian's objection was, why didn't they mention the fifth country that had a wide intercept like the Bahamas? In other words, there's a fifth country out there in which the NSA has taken in everything, and they did not mention the name of that country.
Which country is that, Michael?
We don't know that country yet. And what they said, the reason Glenn Greenwald says he didn't say that is that, and he said he and others agreed, is that people would be injured as a result of telling what that fifth country was that was being broadly surveilled, and that he didn't want people injured. They did publish four out of the five countries, but not the fifth. The Washington Post, on the other hand, published none of the countries. So you have a step forward in Greenwald publishing four of the five. What they said is it had specific credible concerns that could lead to increased violence.
In this former update, Michael Ratner discusses a Guantanamo Bay prison detainee exchange. It's from June 2014. Let's take a listen. Michael Ratner, we've had a high-profile prisoner exchange involving inmates at Guantanamo Bay. What do you think of this?
Well, I think getting rid of everybody at Guantanamo Bay is what we're trying to do. So the fact they got rid of, or let five out, is very, very important and very significant. It's going to be covered in the papers for the next months and months because it was done in an interesting way, and it's the only aspect I'll cover right now in this update. President Obama went contrary to the congressional law that said he had to give Congress 30-day notice before he transferred people out of Guantanamo. What he did here, he transferred five Guantanamo inmates, detainees, who were in the Taliban, perhaps leaders of sorts of the Taliban, or at least very involved with the Taliban, clearly Taliban. It was the demand of the Taliban. And he did it in exchange for an American prisoner who was being held in Afghanistan, presumably by the Taliban. What caused the controversy is normally you have to give 30 days notice to Congress before making a transfer, and then Congress can do its own mucking around here. Now, even though this transfer has been in discussions for a number of months, in fact, years, Obama did it in one day. He said, I'm doing the transfer. Here's the notice. They're gone. They're on the plane. They're in Qatar, I think, for a year under certain kind of restrictions.
Why do you think he did this?
Well, I think
if there was a kind of stealth move in a way.
Well, I think had he done it otherwise, had he given the 30-day notice, Congress would have passed 50 zillion laws, Democrats, Republicans, the whole bunch of those louts would have been in here trying to stop these people leaving Guantanamo. So he did it, I think, for that reason. But what really gets me as a person who represents Guantanamo detainees, my office does, there's 150 people still left there, 149. Over half have been cleared for release, 88, is Obama's speeches. Every time he speaks about Guantanamo, he says, I can't make the transfers because Congress has restricted me from making the transfers. He repeats that. It's not my fault, Obama. I want to close it. Congress has the National Defense Authorization Act, which has a couple of pages in it on restrictions on transfers from Guantanamo. Now, Obama did, when he approved that law, the NDAA, which is the big funding law for the military, he did include a signing statement, something, of course, he'd condemned Bush for years ago, and they don't have any real legal efficacy. But he said, look, I think parts of these laws, particularly the part about the transfers on Guantanamo, entrench on my executive powers, because it's basically my executive power to run foreign policy, run wars, whatever else. So he did say that. Then he goes ahead and, with the Taliban, gives one-day notice, gets him out of there, the five guys. So I say to him, this is all BS. All his excuses that he's made for the last 4 or 5 years, Congress has put restrictions on, are just lies to the American people to let him off the hook. Tomorrow, he could transfer everybody out of there, Congress or no Congress.
Right.
Think about it. Here's five Taliban who I don't actually know how dangerous they were or not. I have no idea. But certainly in the public perception, these are Taliban. Most of the people at Guantanamo were never Taliban. They're like just like people who are picked up, 88 cleared. Why doesn't he just say, oh, I'll transfer them tomorrow. I don't care about Congress at all. But in fact, he hasn't done it. So what this proves to me is when Obama wants to do something, probably for the reason they're beginning to negotiate with the Taliban as they quote, and I put quotes around it, as they claim to be leaving Afghanistan, of course, 2 years from now, and even then, who knows? So I don't believe any of that. But this is about trying to negotiate with the Taliban.
What's interesting is that the American GI that got his freedom from this exchange, he'd been held by the Taliban for 5 years. The right-wing war hawks in Congress are saying this man was a deserter. He walked off his post. He opposed the war in Afghanistan, and he just laid down his gun and drifted away, was picked up by the Taliban, and they put him in prison for 5 years. And they're making a big deal about Obama freeing such a person.
They're claiming that the people who went searching for him, because the theory of our U.S. Army or military is never leave a soldier behind, whatever that means, they leave plenty of dead people behind on all sides of the war, But they claim that a half a dozen people were killed looking for this guy. Now, that's apparently an urban myth that the Times and other papers have sort of destroyed, but it's being carried as fact by even stations like CNN. So they're going after the soldier, they're going after the Taliban, they're going after Obama, and Obama's actually having a reaction. What happened, the original stories were, well, you know, I did sign a signing statement and all this that came out, and they justified it. Now they apologized to both the Democrats and the Republicans. When I say they, Obama administration has now apologized for violating the law. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's outrageous. But what's outrageous
Wait,
is we're
apologize
still...
apologize for violating the law by and, doing this?
Yes.
Oh.
He called up Nancy Pelosi, and right. he apologized. Right.
They apologized.
And what? And can you just explain, he said he... put what in a signing statement?
He put in the signing statement when he signed the NDAA, which does have restrictions on transfers from Guantanamo to other countries and to the U.S., he said he put in a signing statement, I think these restrictions may in an unauthorized way intrude on my executive powers.
Right.
And of course, that's true.
Yes.
So this, so he, his original excuse on the Taliban transfer was essentially that. Then there was such an firestorm in Congress. The president just violated a law, according to Congress, and now the president has backtracked and apologized, both to Democrats and Republicans. Yet, as we talk, of course, over 100 or almost 150 people remain in Guantanamo, 88 of them cleared, 12 years, and Obama is dithering around, but it just shows when he wants to get people out of Guantanamo, he can do it with a flick of his finger.
One of the last times I saw Michael, I was in a singing class with his son Jake and Jake's companion Elena and his daughter Anna and our friend Jennifer Hobbs and my wife Debbie. We took a class on the Upper West Side called Anyone Can Sing, and we were attempting to learn how to sing, and we thought, you know, we'll put Michael on FaceTime and we'll sing his favorite song. Michael's favorite song was the Internationale. And he was home, just out of the hospital, sitting in a padded Barca lounger-type chair in his living room, laying back and looking at us on FaceTime. And we were looking at him through the iPhone, and we sang the first verse, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth, for justice thunders condemnation, a better world's in birth." And we could see him smiling, laying back in the chair. Then we sang the second verse. "No more tradition's chains shall bind us. Arise, ye slaves, no more enthrall. The earth shall rise on new foundations. We have been naught, we shall be all." And Michael was really smiling by then. And then we sang the last verse. And that verse is, "'Tis the final conflict. Let each stand in their place. International humanity shall be the human race." And when we sang the last verse, Michael raised his right fist and he sang along with us in French.
Michael Ratner, I'll really miss you. Bye-bye.
I was dreaming in my dreaming, well, of an aspect bright and fair, and my sleeping here was broken, but my dream, it lingered near, in the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is showered. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear, and the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear, and the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, a laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry, come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise, and we strolled there together, when under laugh or criticize, and the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the Earth's revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. The people have the power. Thank you. Don't forget it. You have the power. Use your voice. And when you break one acoustic guitar string, it's good luck. We broke two. Be positive.